It is just something that I made many, many years ago, and when I left North America to go to South America I was informed that these records had been made without my permission, without my desire, during my absence from the continent. If you want a real record, then purchase the meditation record which I made especially for a record. This was made specially to help people meditate, and it may be obtained from Mr. E. Z. Sota, 33 Ashby Road, Loughborough, Leicestershire, England. I will tell you that Mr. Sota has world rights for this record and for touchstones and many other things, and he is the only person who has my full permission and agreement to sell my records and touchstones. He also sells various other things of my design. That is a free advertisement for Mr. Sota, who is a very decent man and who is trying to do good. This book is not meant to be a catalogue of nice people. It is not meant to be a catalogue of crummy dopes on the outer fringe of sanity either, but I cannot let the book be completed without mentioning a very pleasant family indeed, Mrs. Worstman and her two daughters. You may recall that one of my books was dedicated to Mrs. Worstman, a very pleasant, very highly educated woman whom it is a pleasure to know, and I have known her for several years, known her while her husband was still alive on this earth, and I have been in touch with him now that he is on the other side. Mrs. Worstman, then, is one of the more enlightened types. Certainly she was enlightened enough to have two talented daughters, Louise, who is a nurse in one of the better London hospitals. She is a good nurse, but she is good at so many things. She is artistic. Well, I am not going to list all her virtues, they are too many to put down on these pages. I want to mention, also, her sister, Threes, another talented one. She also is a nurse, and she is very anxious to train as a surgeon. She has all the capabilities for it, everything except the money, in fact. I have been looking around to see if there were any insurance schemes which would enable a highly gifted young woman to get training as a surgeon. Unfortunately, I have not yet found any such source, so if any of you, my readers, know how to raise money whereby an entirely capable young woman can pay for her training at medical school, then now is your chance to do good. I make it absolutely clear, that this young lady has the ability to do some good for the world as a surgeon, and it seems rather dreadful that she may be deprived of the opportunity of doing that good through lack of money to finance hex training. Dealing with a surgeon to be, let us deal with heart transplants. I have a question here. What about the current rash of heart transplants and other radical surgery inserting foreign organs, plastic valves, and tubing, etc. into a body? From a purely material, physiological standpoint, this seems to be considered an almost miraculous scientific breakthrough, but does it do the trick? Will the use of various chemicals counteract the normal tendency of the body to reject any foreign material introduced into it this way? Or is such a rejection inevitable simply because the substituting of a healthy new organ into a body to replace a diseased member won't result in proper meshing between the still diseased etheric of the organ in question with the artificially introduced material counterpart? And, furthermore, is there anything really gained for the individual being operated upon if he is a few months or even years of invalidism added to his present stay on Earth, unless he really uses the time gained thereby to learn some really worthwhile lessons which would otherwise have been deferred to another incarnation? Well, that's a mouthful, certainly. Many hundreds of centuries ago, in the days of Atlantis, people could do transplants. It was possible in those days to graft on an arm or a leg, possible to replace hearts and kidneys and lungs, but it was a providential act of nature that a civilization which did such things came to an end. They tried replacing brains, and they produced amoral monsters. Basically, there is nothing very difficult in replacing a heart. It is just a mechanical procedure. You have to cut out the heart and you have to trim the replacement heart to exactly fit the pipes which are left. Any competent surgeon could do such an operation. In the physical world, one has a semi-invalid. After all, when one does such a radical operation, certain small blood vessels and nerves cannot be rejoined, the whole structure becomes impaired, and so a very sick man is given an added sickness, impairment of his body. But still such a person could go on for an indefinite number of years, go on living a life of semi-invalidism. In the astral world, however, there are two people who are suffering greatly by being cross-mixed. One person is half in the astral, that is, he goes to the astral world during sleep only, and the other person is right in the astral but because his heart or other organ is still living he has a sort of sympathetic attachment through the silver cord of the person who now has that organ. You sometimes get two radios, you switch on two radios in the same room, perhaps on the same program. And if you switch off one then it does make slightly more volume to the second there is some interaction between the two, and these are only radios, only things which some set of girls put together while they were talking about their latest boyfriends and how many their miniskirts would be the next season. When you get to living humans the interaction is much, much stronger, and it definitely, very definitely, impairs the efficiency of a person living in the astral world to be even sympathetically connected to the body of another person. It is my firm belief that replacing organs like this is terribly, criminally wrong, and really people should not permit such abuses of nature. The reflections from the donor's heart show up in the aura of the recipient, and the two people may not have been compatible. The fact that one could be colored and the other white has nothing to do with it. The basic rate of vibration, that is, the frequency of each person, has everything to do with it, and I certainly hope that such transplants can be outlawed. It is a different matter if one is replacing an organ with a synthetic organ because that is no worse than a person wearing glasses or a hearing aid or clothing, no worse than using a crutch. I believe that medical scientists should be encouraged to devise artificial organs which could safely be used on humans. Then there would be no cross-linkage between two entities which causes a handicap to both entities until both are free of their silver cords and living in the astral world. So, to answer this specific question, I am definitely opposed to organ transplants. Here is another question which should be of general interest. It is, information or directions on how few people working devotedly could bring about a change in the course of world affairs. If a few people would definitely think in step on a specific subject, then whatever they think about could actually be so. Nowadays people cannot hold a thought for more than a second or two. If you doubt that, try it yourself, try and think about one specific subject while watching the seconds hand of your watch. You will find, if you are honest, that your attention will waver and wander far more rapidly than you would believe possible. Your attention will only stay more or less constant if you are thinking about something to do with yourself, something you want to do, something which affects you deeply. Anything else such as bringing help to another person whom you have met, well, you cannot hold the interest for very long. People's thought is not constant, and no one thinks of the same thing at the same time with the same intensity. They are like a mass of people milling about, all walking but all out of step, whereas if people could think in step then they could indeed accomplish miracles. If you want to think of this further, consider an army of men, consider a regiment of soldiers marching over a bridge. If those men marched in step across the bridge they would destroy it, and for that reason the men are instructed before going onto the bridge to break step. So they go over walking just as a disorderly rabble would walk, not in step, not in rhythm. And so the building up effect of many men walking in step is destroyed, there isn't the force there any longer, and the bridge is not damaged. If you could get a number of men marching absolutely in step they would destroy any bridge that could be made, and if one kept up the marching they could destroy a building also because the constant pounding down and lifting up would build up such a series of vibrations that the amplitude or degree of vibration would increase and increase beyond the point where the natural elasticity of the bridge or building could encompass it, and then the bridge would just shatter like a broken glass. If one could get, half a dozen people, and get them to think definitely, deliberately in waves of the correct pattern they could topple governments, or build governments, they could make one country preeminent over all others, and they could do things which now would be regarded as utterly impossible. It is perhaps fortunate that it is not too easy to get people to think in unison at exactly the right frequency because, and I am telling you this quite seriously, it is not a joke, if one had a gang of crooks who were trained in thinking correctly they could think open a bank vault. Dear me, what a pity I haven't a nice little gang. It would be very pleasant to have a nice load of money, wouldn't it? Still, it is truly quite possible, and in fact in Atlantean days it was an everyday occurrence. The Catholic chants are a relic of those bygone days, chants which some think are only 2,000 years old, but they are still chants which have been built on the original songs of power of the Sumerians and the Atlanteans. Perhaps I should put it the other way round, Atlanteans and Sumerians because, of course, the Atlanteans are the oldest civilization of the two. In those days it was possible to lift massive chunks of stone by thought, by having a trained mass of priests thinking at the same time under their conductor so that the stone would lift straight up in the air. If you think that is too fantastic, remember that you can make a sound which will break a glass. If you sustain the sound, you can break a glass or break a window, and thought is just another form of sound, that is, a vibration. Everything is a vibration, and if you set the right vibration in motion you can accomplish anything. Another question, readers are wondering when will be the proper time for the free world to know of the time capsules. The proper time is not yet. The proper time is not until the end of this civilization. The end of this civilization as we know it at present. Later, oh, not in your lifetime, so don't worry, much later there will be earthquakes which will really shake the crust of the earth and these time capsules will be thrown up to the surface ready to be opened. There are quite a number of them. One tremendous capsule is in Egypt. I suppose technically it is a capsule, but actually it is a vast chamber deep beneath the shifting sands of the Egyptian desert. The chamber is an absolute museum of artifacts which existed tens of thousands of years ago. Yes, tens of thousands of years ago. There are aircraft of a very, very different type than those in use now, aircraft which work by anti-gravity so that the power of the motor is not expended in supporting the weight but is used just to propel the vehicle forward. I will tell you quite truthfully that I have seen such an aircraft. One device would be especially of interest to the housewife or to the person who has to carry weights. It is a sort of handle which attaches to whatever has to be carried, and then one just catches hold of the handle as when one is carrying a basket. If the parcel or bundle is heavy, then the handle is depressed more. If the parcel is not very heavy, then the handle is not very far depressed. Each of these devices was constructed so that no matter whether the parcel weighed a ton or 10 pounds, the person had no more than about a pound of effort to expend. Anti-gravity was a perfectly ordinary, perfectly common thing in centuries long past, but the priests of that day, who also were the leaders of the armies, got a bit cross with each other, and each side tried bigger and better weapons than the other, with the result that they blew their whole civilization in the air, and it came down as a radioactive dust. Later, when these time capsules are opened, television in three dimensions will be seen, and not just 3D by means of two cameras or two lenses, but a thing in which there appear to be actual people, miniature size, of course, acting out plays, dances, and even debates. Photography too was different in those days. There were no such things as the flat photographs which we now see. Everything was in the solid, more 3D than 3D itself. The nearest thing is the very, very crude holograms with which scientists are just experimenting, in which you can almost look behind the object you had photographed. Well, in the days of Atlantis you could look behind. Hundreds of centuries ago there was the mightiest civilization the world had seen up to that time, but there was such a cataclysm that people became almost demented, those that were left. And they had to start just about from the savage state, and the present so-called age of science has barely reached what would be called the kindergarten stage when Atlantis was at its peak. Many people disbelieve in Atlantis, which, of course, is just utterly foolish. They are like the fishermen who go out fishing, and because they don't catch anything they say, oh, there are no fish in the seas anymore. They have all died off. Yes, there was an Atlantis. And there are living remnants of Atlantis still, deep underground in a certain part of the world, and let me make clear here that that part of the world is not Mount Shasta. Don't believe all the hooey you read or are told about Mount Shasta. This is just an ordinary area which has been overpublicized by people who wanted to make not just a fast buck, but a whole sack of them. I wish I could tell you some of the things I absolutely, definitely know, but there are certain things which cannot be told at present. I know the actual truth about the submarines Thresher and Scorpion, and I know what happened to them and why. The story, if it could be told, would make cold chills run up and down your spine, but the time is not yet. There are many things which could be told, but, well, these books circulate everywhere, many, many people read them, and there are many people who should not be aware that certain people know what is really going on. You can take it, though, that the mystery of the Thresher and the Scorpion is a stranger thing than you would ever believe. But you seem so very interested in animals, said the letter, and yet you say that you do not believe in vegetarianism. Why? How do you reconcile the two, a love of animals and a dislike of vegetarianism? I believe most firmly that man has a body which at this stage of existence needs meat for its sustenance. Now, let me tell you something. Countless years ago, years and years and years ago, there was a form of man who was entirely a vegetarian. He was so busy eating that he had no time for anything else. It never occurred to him to eat meat, and so that he could deal with the tremendous bulk of vegetables, fruit and nuts necessary, he had an additional organ, the last vestigial remnant of which is the appendix. The experiment was a complete failure. The gardeners of the earth found that vegetarian man was inefficient because, to take in the necessary amount of cellulose matter to enable him to do any worthwhile work was quite a prohibitive matter. He would have to be eating all the time, eating for so long that there would not be any time left for him to do any constructive work. And so the gardeners of the earth scrapped that type of man, or, if you don't like the word scrapped, let us say that through evolution mankind turned into a meat eater. We have to face basic facts, and one of the basic facts is this: all vegetable matter is cellulose supported. Now, you imagine lace curtains, a nice open work net, and then you stuff the holes with paste stuff containing food substance. Supposing you had to eat the lace curtains in order that the food value packed in the holes could be absorbed into your body. It sounds a bit fantastic, doesn't it? But that's just what you do when you eat a lot of lettuce or cabbage or other vegetable or fruit stuff. What you are eating is a cellulose sponge, the holes of which are packed with food. But the sponge material takes up a lot of room, and so to get an adequate amount of food one has to take a quite excessive bulk of cellulose, and the poor wretched body cannot digest cellulose, you know, it has to be excreted. In all my life I have never, never met a vegetarian who could do any hard work. Of course if he was sitting on his behind all day letting other people do the work, then no doubt he could get by, but he wouldn't be very bright. If by any chance he was bright, then you could take it that if he lived naturally he would be a darn sight brighter. Quite truly, have you ever seen a navvy or a person who does hard manual work who could live on vegetables and fruits only? You haven't, have you, now you come to think of it? But let us get back to our animal business. I am truly an animal lover, I love all animals, and I can assure you that animals know they have to die sometime, and it helps their own karma if they can die for a useful purpose. Animals who are raised for food are looked after, they are bred carefully, any sickness is treated. The herd is very carefully supervised so that there are only healthy animals. In the wild state you get animals who are diseased or stunted, or who have been injured in some way, or even those who have some disease such as cancer or lung trouble, and they just have to drag out a miserable existence. Supposing an animal breaks a leg, then it has to live out a really miserable existence until it dies in pain and starvation, yet any herd animal would be cared for immediately. If no one killed any animals, then soon the world would be overrun with animals of every type. There would be cattle in large numbers, and the greater the number of cattle, then the greater the number of predator animals which nature herself would provide to keep down the number of cattle. If humans eat meat, then it's to their advantage to kill an animal painlessly and quickly. In killing an animal for food, one is also keeping down the numbers of animals and keeping them in check, so that in growing to uncontrollable numbers and in running wild, the stock does not become downgraded. Now, whether we like it or not, humans also have to be kept in check so far as their numbers are concerned. If there are too many humans, then inevitably there is a big war or a serious earthquake, or some sort of plague or illness which carries off large numbers of humans. That is just the gardeners of the earth thinning out the ranks, cutting down on surplus people. People, after all, are just animals of a different type. And all the people who fairly yowl with anguish at the thought of a person eating a piece of beef, well, how about eating a live lettuce? If one eats a piece of beef or chicken, the original owner of the flesh is no longer able to feel the bites, yet people go and eat live lettuce, eat live pears. So how do they reconcile their so-called humanitarian principles? Science, cynical and skeptical though it be, has now discovered that plants have feelings. Plants will grow better when they are tended by people who are sympathetic to them. Plants respond to music. There are instruments which can indicate how much pain a plant is enduring. You may not hear a cabbage shriek when you tear off its outside leaves, no, because it has no vocal cords, and yet there are instruments which can record that shriek of pain as a burst of static. This is not fairy tale stuff, it's actual fact. It's stuff that has been investigated and proved again. In research laboratories in Russia, England and the USA, it has been proved. When you pick some berries and stuff them in your mouth, well, how about the feelings of the plant? You don't go and tear a lump off a cow and stuff it in your mouth, do you? If you try to, the cow would soon object, but because a plant cannot make its pain known, you think you are a jolly wonderful humanitarian when you eat plants instead of meat, which cannot feel the pain of being eaten. Quite frankly, I believe that vegetarians are a lot of cranks and crackpots, and if they would only come off their stupid attitudes and remember that the gardeners of the earth designed their bodies for certain food, then they would be a lot better in their mental health. If you have a car, you wouldn't drain the sump and fill it up with water, would you, and say you couldn't possibly use oil because it might come from the earth somewhere and hurt somebody underground. If you try to run your body on food for which it is not designed, you are being just the same as a person who won't use oil in the sump of his car but instead uses salt water. If we are going to be logical and if we are going to say that vegetarianism is good, then how about the practice of using cut flowers in one's rooms? Plants are living entities, and when you cut flowers, you are cutting off the sex organs of the plants and sticking them in vases, and actually humans would be shockingly unhappy if their sex organs were cut off and stuck in vases for some different race to enjoy. Let me digress here to say that when I was in hospital, I received a very pleasant surprise. A group of very kind ladies as far away as the Pacific coast of the USA had wired to a florist in the city of St. John to have some plants delivered to me at the hospital. I appreciated it very much indeed. The ladies did not give any address, but I was able to locate them. A personal choice, I do not like cut flowers. It seems to me such a pity to cut them off. Instead, I very much prefer a complete plant. Here one has a living thing which is growing and not just dying. I often think people who send great bunches of cut flowers, well, why not cut off the heads of small children and impale them on sticks and put those in a room? Have you ever thought of the state this old earth of ours is in? It's quite a mess, you know. Compare it to a garden. Now, if the garden is properly maintained, there are no weeds or anything like that, all pests are kept in check. There is no blight on the trees and the fruits are full and healthy. Plants have to be thinned out, the sickly ones have to be removed. Every so often fruit trees have to be pruned, sometimes there are grafts taken. It is necessary to carefully supervise the garden and to prevent cross-pollination between undesirable species. If the garden is maintained as it should be, it becomes a thing of beauty. But let the gardeners go away. Let the garden remain idle for a year or two. Weeds will grow and will choke and kill off the more delicate plants, unchecked pests will come, and blight will appear on the trees. No longer will there be round, film fruits, but soon they will be shriveled, wrinkled up with all sorts of brown spots. A sadly neglected garden is a tragic sight. Or let us go from the garden to livestock. Have you ever seen wild ponies on a moor, or wild cattle where the grazing is poor? They become stunted, some of them suffer from rickets, many suffer from skin diseases. Generally they are a pretty pathetic sight, little dwarf creatures, unkempt and very, very wild. Look at a well-maintained stockyard. Here you see pedigree animals carefully bred, faults bred out of them in fact. You get fine pedigree horses or excellent pedigree cows. They are healthy, they are large and substantial looking, they appear glad to be alive, and you can look at them with pleasure knowing that they are not going to start away from you in fright. They know they are looked after. Now think of the earth, think of the people here. The stock is getting poorer and poorer. People are becoming more vicious, people are listening to more depraved music and watching ever more obscene pictures. Now it is no longer an age when beauty and spirituality count, no longer do people love good music, love good pictures, everything is being torn down. You cannot get a great man without some moronic clod trying to say unkind things about him. One of the greatest men of modern times, Sir Winston Churchill, probably saved the world from being under the cloud of communism, yet even Sir Winston Churchill had his detractors just because of the spirit of evil which pervades the atmosphere nowadays. The garden which is the earth which is our world has gone to seed. Weeds grow apace. You can see them in the streets with their long hair and dirty complexions, and if you can't see them you can jolly well smell them yards off. The races need pruning. Stock needs replenishing and soon will come the time when the gardeners of the earth come back for their periodical inspection and find conditions here to be quite intolerable. Something will be done about it. Mankind will not be left to go to bad seed as it has of late. There will come a time when all the races of man will unite, when there will no longer be black people and white people and yellow people and red people. The whole world will be peopled by the race of Dan, and that will be the predominating color. Dan. With the coming of the race of Dan there will be much fresh life injected in the human race. People will again value the better things of life. People will again value spiritual things, and when mankind gets spiritual to a sufficient degree, it will be possible for mankind once again to talk by telepathy with the gods, the gardeners of the earth. At present man has sunk in the slough of despond, sunk in his own lack of spirituality. Sunk so low that his basic vibrations are reduced to such an extent that he cannot be heard telepathically by any creature higher, not even by his fellows. But the time will come when all that will be remedied. I'm not trying to sell you Buddhism, nor Christianity, nor Judaism, but I am saying quite definitely that there will have to be a return to some form of religion, because only religion can give one the necessary spiritual discipline which will convert an unholy rabble of humanity to a disciplined spiritual group of people, who can carry on the race instead of having it ploughed under and a fresh set of entities placed here. Now, in the present state of dissonance, even Christians fight against Christians. The war in Northern Ireland between Catholics and Protestants, it doesn't matter who is right or who is wrong, they are both alleged to be Christians, they are both alleged to follow the same religion. Does it matter whether one sect crosses himself with the left hand while another does it with the right hand? It's much the same as one of the stories in Gulliver's Travels where the people of one mythical country went to war about which end of an egg should be opened first, the small end or the broad end. How can Christianity possibly try to convert other nations, other religions, when Christians fight against Christians, because both Catholics and Protestants are Christians? Chapter 10. The gem cannot be polished without friction, nor man perfected without trials. Breakfast was soon over. One doesn't take long to consume a breakfast consisting solely of 150-gram boiled egg, one piece of bread, and 5 grams of butter. The 2 cups of tea permitted did not take long going down the hatch either. The old man pressed the button on the left-hand side of the bed and a motor whirred, and the back section lifted up, to a 45-degree inclination. "Oh," smiled Cleo, "I do love it when that thing goes up. Well, I have to work now, and you wretches mustn't disturb me again. You know what fun we had yesterday, don't you?" The end of Miss Cleo's tail twitched with amusement, and she sauntered off to her accustomed place on the windowsill right over the radiator. "What fun yesterday?" asked Trab. "I don't remember any fun yesterday." The old man looked up and said, "I tried to do some of the book in the afternoon, and Fat Cat Taddy said I mustn't do it. She said I didn't look well enough, and when I wouldn't stop she told me again, and then she kept jumping at me and slapping me." "Good for her," said Trab, "she's just looking after you."